Well, we're nearing the end of the strokes or the plagues against Egypt that Jehovah has ordained in order that Pharaoh will agree to release the Hebrews from their bondage. Now, last week and this week's lessons run a little bit long only so we can maintain some continuity. So far, nothing has worked. Pharaoh's heart has become progressively intransigent in proportion to this escalating series of calamities that the Lord has visited upon Egypt. Now, some of this hardening at Pharaoh's heart has been Jehovah. Some has been Pharaoh's iron will. Now, even more, it's become apparent to the Egyptian people, as well as to the government, that the Hebrews are being somehow miraculously spared from all except for the first two of these series of disasters. So open your Bibles to Exodus chapter 10. We're going to read it all. If you have a complete Jewish Bible, it's page 70. Exodus chapter 10. I need you to follow along with me. Exodus chapter 10. Adonai said to Moshe, "Go to Pharaoh, for I have made him and his servants hard-hearted, so that I can demonstrate these signs of mine among them, so that you can tell your son and grandson about what I did to Egypt and about my signs that I demonstrated among them, and so that you will all know that I'm Adonai." Moshe and Aharon went into Pharaoh and said to him, "Here is what Adonai, God of the Hebrews, says. How much longer will you refuse to submit to me? Let my people go so that they can worship me. Otherwise, if you refuse to let my people go, tomorrow I'll bring locusts into your territory. One won't be able to see the ground, so completely will the locusts cover it. They will eat everything and anything you have that has escaped the hail, including every tree you have growing in the field. They will fill your houses, those of your servants, and of all the Egyptians. It'll be nothing like your fathers or their fathers have ever seen since the day they were born until today." And then he turned his back and he left. Pharaoh's servants said to him, "How much longer must this fellow be a snare for us? Let the people go and worship Adonai their God. Don't you understand yet that Egypt is being destroyed?" So Moses and Aaron were brought to Pharaoh again, and he said to them, "Go, worship Adonai your God. But who exactly is going?" And Moses answered, "We will go with our young and our old, our sons and our daughters, and we will go with our flocks and herds, for we must celebrate a feast to Adonai." And Pharaoh said to them, "Adonai certainly will be with you if I ever let you go with your children. It's clear that you are up to no good. Nothing doing. Just the men among you may go and worship Adonai. That's what you want, isn't it?" And they were driven out of Pharaoh's presence. Adonai said to Moshe, "Reach out your hand over the land of Egypt so that the locusts will invade the land and eat every plant that the hail has left." Moses reached out with his staff over the land of Egypt, and Adonai caused an east wind to blow on the land all day and all night, and in the morning the east wind brought the locusts. The locusts went up all over the land of Egypt, settled throughout Egypt's territory. It was an invasion more severe than there had ever been before or ever will be again. They completely covered the ground so that the ground looked black. They ate every plant growing from the ground and all the fruit of the trees left by the hail. Not one green thing remained, not a tree, not a plant in the field in all the land of Egypt. Pharaoh hurried to summon Moshe and Aharon and said, "I have sinned against Adonai your God and against you. Now therefore, please forgive my sin just this once and intercede with Adonai your God so that he will at least take away from me this deadly plague." He went out from Pharaoh and interceded with Adonai. Adonai reversed the wind, made it blow very strongly from the west. It took up the locusts and drove them into the Sea of Suf. Not one locust remained on Egyptian soil. But Adonai made Pharaoh hard-hearted, and he didn't let the people of Israel go. Adonai said to Moshe, "Reach out your hand towards the sky, and there will be darkness over the land of Egypt, darkness so thick it can be felt. Moses reached out his hand towards the sky, and there was a thick darkness in the entire land of Egypt for 3 days. People couldn't see each other. No one went anywhere for 3 days. But all the people of Israel had light in their homes. Pharaoh summoned Moses and said, "Go worship Adonai, only leave your flocks and herds behind. Your children may go with you." And Moses answered, "You must also see to it that we have sacrifices and burnt offerings so that we can sacrifice to Adonai our God. Our livestock will also go with us. Not a hoof will be left behind, because we must choose some of them to worship Adonai our God, and we don't know which ones we will need to worship Adonai till we get there." But Adonai made Pharaoh hard-hearted, and he wouldn't let them go. Pharaoh said to him, "Get away from me, and you had better not see my face again, because the day you see my face, you will die." Moses answered, "Well spoken. I will see your face no more." Well, we might look at these plagues against Egypt, you know, the bloody water, the hail, skin lesions, now locusts, and see them as too primitive sounding. Something we'd only find in backward nations, and maybe even think about them as downright quaint. All right, that is, if the Lord was doing this, say, in our day, in Europe, America, the plagues would be a lot zippier. You know, I mean, they'd have more modern and technological sources, and they'd appeal that they would kind of play well at a local movie theater. You know, I mean, with nuclear bombs and bioweapons and electrical grid failure and computer chips being neutralized and aliens attacking from outer space or something. But if we think about it, every one of these strokes we're reading about in Exodus would be just as devastating today anywhere in the world as it was 3,500 years ago in Egypt. Imagine if our drinking water became polluted on a near universal scale. Could we use enough filtration to solve it? Probably, but at great expense, and only the wealthiest nations would initially have it available. Hundreds of millions would die from little more than tainted water. Look at what a simple storm, Hurricane Katrina, did to New Orleans and to the surrounding area a few years ago, how it bludgeoned America's economy and came near to toppling the sitting president. Nothing particularly high-tech about a hurricane, is it, Floridians? I mean, just isn't. Just a big wind, a lot of rain, a lot of water. Recall the Mount St. Helens disaster a few years ago. The devastation it caused, the loss of life, the cost to Washington State's economy, and thousands of acres of woodlands destroyed for decades to come. All this from a million-year-old volcano that does little more than spew smoke, heat, and molten rock. How about that recent Japanese tsunami just a few years ago? The estimated 20,000 lives that it took, the countless billions of dollars in damage it caused, enormous radiation leakage from a series of nuclear power plants that were affected. All this from an earthquake and a resultant wave of seawater. Man, you can't get much more low-tech than that. When we look ahead at the end-time scenarios of the Bible, and we are told of these cataclysmic events that will eclipse all of human history, we typically want to convert the visions of God's prophets describing these events into high-tech, science-gone-mad experiments. So we hear of Christian scholars and writers thinking this must be about a nuclear exchange, maybe a horrible chemical or biological weapon unleashed. We think in terms of Star Wars types of weapons. In fact, nothing man has invented or is likely to invent has ever approached the power of a single thunderstorm or a medium-sized asteroid entering our atmosphere and striking our planet. And as a result, when people look back at these horrible upheavals of nature over the last few years, we tend to completely dismiss the hand of God. And we say, hey, this is just nature doing what nature does. Don't make it one of those wacko religious judgment pronouncements. Well, perhaps the ancients said that it was just nature doing its thing in Egypt. Perhaps people in the future will say it's nature doing its thing at the end of days. But make no mistake, when it does happen, it will happen at God's command. It'll be unstoppable. It will not likely be because men made it happen, as with the modern man-made global warming crowd contingency is so certain of. As we should be learning by now, we need to discover God's pattern in how he deals with humanity and with nature. And when we see how he's done it up to now, it certainly has not been by means of technological advancements. The coming cataclysms are not likely to be ordained or solved by human beings. Now, let me take a momentary detour to connect some dots. For those of you who have interest in prophecy, particularly end times prophecy, very few Bible scholars, except for the most liberal, who view the Bible as nothing more than an example of ancient Hebrew literature and a bunch of fanciful tales, none of them would say that these 9 plagues upon Egypt were symbolic or allegorical or metaphorical. That is, they weren't real. And the words mean something else entirely when we read them. Well, mainstream scholars take the Exodus plagues in general as literal, even if a few of them regard these miracles as nothing more than natural occurrences with no more or less frequency or intensity than is normally seen. It's only the wording of the Bible that embellishes and exaggerates and makes them highly dramatic. So it's fascinating to me that these same scholars who take the Exodus account of the plagues as literal, more often than not, regard the Revelation accounts of the seal and bowl judgments as symbolic and not literal. Most of the judgments of Revelation use the same natural elements, only greatly amplified and has a much wider spread than the Exodus accounts of the plagues do. Hail, insects, darkness, boils, oceans and rivers turning blood red, and sea life die, these all occur in Exodus, and they also occur in Revelation. And then, of course, there are the Revelation judgments that are not in the Exodus plagues. But still, they exist and occur naturally. Earthquakes, stars exploding, meteors penetrating through our atmosphere. Now, I only bring this up to kind of close the loop of this concept that I'm hoping to teach to you, that God's patterns and his principles repeat all throughout history. They will continue to repeat until the end of time. We see these same God patterns in Revelation, just as they were originally established in the Torah, even with the same characteristics of how judgments are meted out. Now, I know many of you are interested in end times prophecy, so be aware that when you read of these incredibly destructive end times phenomena in Revelation, that they are of the same substance and design as what we're reading in the Exodus account. You can take them literally. You should take them literally, because these things have happened before, literally. It is God's way to deal in a very consistent fashion with mankind at large and with the world and with his own people. Well, chapter 10 begins with yet another instruction by God to Moses to go to Pharaoh, and he reminds Moses he has worked within Pharaoh's soul to keep his heart hardened for a divine purpose. The purpose is that all of these miracles and signs will inevitably occur and that they will be seen and remembered among the Hebrews from generation to generation, and that he has used Egypt for Israel's sake. Now, sometimes we have a hard time with this concept that God would favor one above the other. Doesn't sound very tolerant, does it? Sounds rather discriminatory. He even allows one to be destroyed and or ransomed to save the other. In this case, it's the Egyptians who would pay a high price for God's purposes, and that God would keep a human's heart, Pharaoh's, hardened in order to achieve his purposes. I have often heard from believers and unbelievers alike that it's just not fair of God to do these things. Well, I suppose if we actually believe that, we can sit in judgment of God. And then maybe we can debate his fairness if that's the case. I don't feel I need to defend God's decisions. And I don't have any right to question them. His laws and commands are what they are. And they're perfect. All we need to know is what they are. We don't have to know why they are. Have you been brought up in a congregation by any chance? Been brought up to believe that all of God's decisions are for your best benefit? I'm sorry to tell you, they're not. God's decisions are intended to achieve his purposes to the best benefit of his kingdom, not for the benefit of our personal, individual, earthly well-being. Our happiness, our comfort, our successes are all entirely secondary to God's far greater divine purpose of bringing in his kingdom. Well, in verse 4, Moses announces to Pharaoh that if he does not free God's people today, that tomorrow Egypt's going to be hit with a plague of locusts. And not only will the ground be so thick with them that the soil will seem to disappear, but also what's left of the crops in the fields from the destructive hailstorm is going to be eaten up by these voracious insects. Even more, these insects are going to find their way into people's homes. Now, we can wonder as to whether Pharaoh believed Moses or not. But his sorcerers, his advisors, and the Egyptian people, oh yeah, they believed. They begged Pharaoh to let Israel go so that they could again live in peace. In fact, they say in verse 7, Pharaoh, don't you understand that Egypt is already devastated? The battle with this Jehovah is lost. We can't take anymore. Apparently, Aaron and Moses left Pharaoh's presence for a short time so that Pharaoh could kind of consider matters. Then they returned for his answer. Well, the tide's turning. Pharaoh is getting more serious about letting Israel go because he says, okay, go serve your God. But who among you is going to go? Implying, of course, the more important question of who's going to stay. Now, for this, however, there was no compromise. Moses answered, our young ones, our old ones, our boys, our girls, and all of their livestock. In other words, not just all the people, but all their possessions are going to go too. The matter is now crystal clear to Pharaoh. His paranoia that Israel would leave permanently has just been confirmed. Why would every last Hebrew, along with every last head of their livestock, need to go for a 3-day pilgrimage? No, Pharaoh thinks, they plan on leaving forever. So in verses 10 and 11, Pharaoh says, no way, Moses. Now I will allow only the males among you to go. The women and the children and the livestock have to be left behind. That's his final answer. And Moses and Aaron are again thrown out of the palace. Now, of course, that wasn't good enough for God. So he tells Moses to stretch out his hand, and that is, Moses was to order the locusts to come. Now, this eighth plague is set into motion, and an east wind begins to blow, and on the flow of that wind will come the locusts. A horde of locusts, as has never seen before, devoured everything in their path. Now, here again, we see God use nature itself, as in all the previous plagues, to strike the Egyptians. Pharaoh took one look at this, and he called for Moses and Aaron. And he brings them in and does as he had done earlier. He confesses he sinned against God. Got that much right. But this time, and yet another step, Pharaoh even asked for forgiveness. Now, this wasn't true repentance any more than his belief that Jehovah exists is trust and love. It was just the use of whatever means was necessary, even if it meant groveling, to remove this disastrous plague. Now, if this didn't stop the locusts, it would drive Egypt into death through starvation. Pharaoh finally was sensing what all this was leading up to, so he started begging for mercy. Yet the minute Jehovah reversed the wind, sending the locusts back eastward and into the Great Sea, Pharaoh's heart again hardened. He wouldn't free Israel. Well, this time God is credited with doing the hardening of Pharaoh's irredeemable heart. Now, according to the now well-established pattern, verse 21 brings us the ninth stroke, or the third plague of the third set of plagues. Therefore, what's the characteristic of that third of each one? It goes unannounced. It is not announced to Pharaoh. It's not announced to the Egyptian people. They're not expecting it. And this stroke is the most terrible of them all up to this point. Darkness. Darkness that is a foreshadowing of the final death, of spiritual death, of evil. A darkness that is not only seen, it's so thick, it is literally felt. A darkness that is far more than just the absence of light. It is a darkness that lasted 3 days throughout Egypt, but it didn't happen in Goshen, as we read that in verse 23. Now please pay close attention to what I'm about to tell you. What God did here, he also did at creation. That is, he separated, he made a distinction. That is, he elected and he divided the darkness from the light. Over the ones who held his people in servitude, darkness. Over his own people who served him, light. Now, we ought to not overlook four little words in verse 21. They will feel darkness. The Egyptians felt the darkness, while the Israelites felt the light. How does one feel darkness or light? Remember, in our first lesson of Torah, when we studied creation, we found that when God created light in Genesis 1:3, that it was different than the type of lights used to create visual light waves. That was created in Genesis 1:14. The word used for light, the light that would remain over Israel in Goshen in Exodus 10, verse 23, is the same word that God used in Genesis 1:3. In Hebrew, that word is or. Or. In a nutshell, it means enlightenment. That is, enlightenment is something good as opposed to something evil. The truth as opposed to a lie. When you switch on a lamp, you get visual light. That type of light is talked about in Genesis 1:14. When you hear from God, you get spiritual light, enlightenment, the type of light talked about back in Genesis 1:3. There's a difference. We talked about the light over the Hebrews. So what kind of darkness then enveloped the Egyptians? Again, the same Hebrew word is used in Genesis to describe the opposite of or, enlightenment. And that word is chosek, chosek. And chosek means darkness, not like nighttime, but rather a very negative kind of darkness. A kind of darkness that blots out good. A kind of darkness that leads men into wrong, into evil. The same wordplay that is at the beginning of Genesis, when God creates a distinction between God's enlightenment versus spiritual depravity, light versus dark, is used right here in Exodus to describe the condition of Egypt. Darkness as opposed to the condition of Israel, enlightenment. Yet the account also makes it clear that visual light and darkness were also involved. So let us not make a metaphor out of verse 23 where it says a man could not see his brother, nor could he arise from his spot. Or as a complete Jewish Bible says, people couldn't see each other. What kind of circumstances could cause such dense visual darkness? Just being without sunlight or even moonlight would not have created such a darkness as is being described here. I mean, the Egyptians, as with all other cultures, they didn't know how to deal with nighttime. They had oil lamps and fire pits and torches, all manner of way of going about their businesses after dark. The idea that no one could move from their spot, it was so dark. That is, they couldn't even see enough to move around, does not reflect a typical nighttime experience. No, this was not three 24-hour periods of nighttime. There are natural conditions that do happen from time to time, which brings a type of darkness in which the darkness actually seems to absorb the light. I'm from California originally, and I've encountered two of these conditions. Fog and a dust storm. I've been on Highway 101 outside of Santa Barbara, California, when the fog was so dense that one's high beams wouldn't penetrate any more than 5 or 6 feet in front of the car, and I mean that literally. I've been in sandstorms in the Mojave Desert where the sun was completely blotted out at midday. But in Egypt, there came occasionally a brutal type of a dust storm called a khamsin. A khamsin. Every few years, a combination of conditions collided that caused the air itself to just become charged with static electricity. It would literally lift and suspend super fine particles of dust in the air alongside the coarser particles of sand that fierce winds normally carry. If anyone here has ever spent any time in super dry climates, you know that static electricity is a normal everyday phenomenon that you have to deal with. I mean, clothing sticks to other clothing. You get shocked grabbing the handle, door handle of your car. You pull a wool sweater over your head in a darkened room and you'll get a light show. These khamsin dust storms turn day into night. And especially in ancient times when doors didn't seal and windows were just open holes in a wall, dust came indoors pretty easily. indoors, you can escape the winds and the sandblasting effect of the storm, but you can't escape the thick dust clouds caused by the electrically charged air. Indoors became dark as well. Oil lamps would not have helped. Mobility ended. I suspect this is what occurred as far as the visual element of light is concerned. Otherwise, it'd be out of character with the 8 previous plagues that all involved natural elements of nature. Of course, this Khamsin dust storm was of a supernatural origin and was several times more ferocious than happens in nature by itself. So fierce was it that it frightened Pharaoh and the Egyptian people out of their wits. But the real fright undoubtedly came in this feeling. This choshek, this spiritual darkness, this evil that hovered over them like a blanket. The type, you know, that makes the hair on the back of your neck stand up on end when you can't see anything dangerous, but you just, I don't know, somehow you sense it. This was a time of true horror for Egypt. But in the same land, just a few miles north, the Israelites were celebrating with joy. This ninth plague of the book of Exodus is just like the irony a believer experiences in this present world. Darkness, choshech, and enlightenment, or exist side by side. We who are covered with God's light live in the same space, the same time, the same dimension. We breathe the same air as the majority of the world, but they are under a blanket of darkness and they're completely unaware of it. At the same time that we can have our hearts broken, we can weep for those in servitude to the prince of this darkness. We can and we should celebrate that God's enlightenment is upon us and all of our brethren who trust him. By the way, notice that only Israel received the light. It's no different today. We non-Israelites by birth through Yeshua have been joined to Israel's covenants. That which benefits Israel now benefits us as well. So Pharaoh sends out an urgent call for Moses. And still, this foolish, rebellious king tries to bargain with God. We've never tried that, of course, but after the previous stroke, he agreed to let only the Israelite males go to worship. You know, Pharaoh says that if Moses will get God to call off this darkness, then all of Israel can go. Man, woman, boy, girl, young, old, but their livestock has to stay behind. Moses declines the offer, says everything must go. Why? Because it says in verse 26, Jehovah has called Israel to serve him and sacrifice to him, but they don't know exactly what is to be involved. In other words, maybe God's going to want all their livestock. Maybe just some of it. Maybe he won't want any at all. They don't know. Maybe he'll want sheep, maybe cattle, maybe goats. They haven't been told. So the only thing they can do is take all their people, all their possessions into the desert, set them before God to see what he might demand of them. Gee, I hope that's causing the wheels to turn a little bit. Here is another permanent God principle that just bursts out of nowhere. We are to submit all that we have, all that we are before God. Ourselves, our families, our possessions, because we cannot possibly know at any given moment what he's going to demand of us. We must go forward in faith and trust and hold nothing back. Nothing. It's all his. It's his to give or to take as pleases him. But what's our typical response to that? okay, God, you can have everything but this. You can take that, just don't take that thing over there. You can have me, just don't touch my job. Don't mess with my health or my wife or my children. Those things that the Israelites would have left behind at Pharaoh's orders would have remained in servitude. So Moses had no choice but to refuse. Everything, listen, everything we leave behind yet still possess, everything that we do not take with us to present to God when we approach the cross of salvation stays in Egypt. It remains in bondage and servitude and is therefore not available. It's not suitable to serve God. God has made it clear that everything we are and that we possess must be laid before Him when we turn our life over to Him. Neither Moses nor Pharaoh would budge. Moses won't leave without the livestock. Pharaoh won't let Israel go with it. Pharaoh orders Moses to leave his presence, never come back. Because if he ever approaches Pharaoh again, Moses is going to be put to death. Pharaoh has, by his own words, sealed his and his people's fate. There will be no more opportunities to avoid judgment. God does not strive with man forever. The mercy ends. We don't know ahead of time exactly when or where that turning point is. But when it does end, when God decides to turn us over to our innate wickedness, all hope of redemption vanishes forever. Scary, scary thought. And it's oh so terribly true. Let's move on to Exodus chapter 11. Short chapter. Exodus chapter 11 on page 71 if you have a complete Jewish Bible. Adonai said to Moshe, I'm going to bring still one more plague on Pharaoh in Egypt, and after that he'll let you leave here. When he does let you go, he will throw you out completely. Now tell the people that every man is to ask his neighbor, every woman her neighbor, for gold and silver jewelry. Adonai made the Egyptians favorably disposed towards the people. Moreover, Moses was regarded by Pharaoh's servants and the people as a very great man in the land of Egypt. And Moses said, here is what Adonai says. About midnight, I will go out into Egypt, and all the firstborn in the land of Egypt will die. From the firstborn of Pharaoh sitting on his throne to the firstborn of the slave girl at the handmill, all the firstborn of the livestock. There will be a horrendous wailing throughout all the land of Egypt. There's never been another like it. There will never be another again. But not even a dog's growl will be heard against any of the people of Israel, neither against people nor against animals. In this way, you will realize that Adonai distinguishes between Egyptians and Israel. All your servants will come down to me, prostrate themselves before me, and say, get out, you and all the people who follow you, and after that I will go out. And he went out from Pharaoh in the heat of anger. Adonai said to Moshe, Pharaoh will not listen to you, so that still more of my wonders will be shown in the land of Egypt. Moses and Aaron did all these wonders before Pharaoh, but Adonai had made Pharaoh hard-hearted, and he did not let the people of Israel leave his land. I always feel like I want to end that chapter with the words, uh-oh. Well, judgment arrives. Well, what we're going to see in chapters 11 and 12 is judgment. Now, what's judgment? It's the time which we receive what is due to us, according to God's system of justice. In the Bible, judgment almost always results in a negative consequence. We all, saved and unsaved, are going to be judged. If we're saved, however, if we trust God by way of his son Yeshua, we won't be condemned. And we will not be the subjects of God's wrath. If we are not saved, we will be condemned. Pharaoh and Egypt had been given 9 chances to accept God's will. They would not obey him. This 10th blow upon Egypt brings with it no choices. This isn't another warning. It's not another chance for Pharaoh and for Egypt to repent. The time for warnings and choices passed with the end of the 9th plague. Egypt's fate is etched in cosmic concrete. The so-called 10th plague equates to what happens when we die and we stand before God. Some will live in darkness forever. Remember the spiritual word, or rather the Hebrew word for spiritual darkness, choshek. Others will live forever in light. The Hebrew word for this light, this enlightenment, is or. From this condition, there will be no change. Whether we're put into light or to darkness, there will be, from that point forward, no opportunity for change. And it will be that way for us for all eternity. The first 3 verses of chapter 11 were either spoken to Moses before or during the last audience that Moses had with the Pharaoh. In other words, we saw in chapter 10, after Pharaoh called for Moses when God covered Egypt with choshek, spiritual darkness, and with visual darkness, that then when Moses refused Pharaoh's offer for all Israel to leave with the condition of their livestock behind Pharaoh, leaving their livestock behind, Pharaoh told Moses in a fit of rage he was never to come back again. Now we find out in Exodus 11:8 that during that same conversation, Moses had raged right back at the Pharaoh. We see that not only did Moses refuse Pharaoh's offer, but also Moses told him that that night, about midnight, all of Egypt's firstborn would die. That death included, according to verse 5, even the livestock. But the Israelites would not be affected, they or their livestock. Now, while I don't blame Cecil B. DeMille for depicting that which killed the Egyptian firstborn as a green cloud of death that kind of floated menacingly around the streets of Egypt, I mean, what was it going to show? It does kind of give us the wrong impression. I've even heard Bible teachers say it was the angel of death that wandered throughout all of Egypt and killed the Egyptian firstborn. No, it was not. It was Jehovah himself who took all those lives. How exactly that occurred, we don't know, except that it was by Almighty God's very own hand that the life of those firstborns was extinguished. Verse 1 says that Jehovah, it does not say the Lord, it does not say Adonai, it does not say Malach Adonai, angel of the Lord, anything like that. Jehovah says, I will bring one more plague. Then in verse 4 he says, here's what Jehovah says, about midnight I will go out. He killed all the firstborn of Egypt. And after this terrible judgment, God says, now Pharaoh will release you. In fact, he is going to drive you out of Egypt. But before Israel leaves, they're going to strip Egypt. They're to ask for gold and silver from the Egyptian people. They're going to get all they ask for, because verse 3 says the Hebrews found favor in the eyes of the Egyptians and that they saw that Moses was a very great man. Translation. Please, take anything you want. We can't fight Moses. We can't find your God. Just leave us. To the bulk of the Egyptian people, Moses was just a powerful sorcerer, more powerful than Egypt's magicians. They had no more interest in testing him further. Now, frankly, this was no different from the Egyptian perspective than if a robber was holding a knife at their throat, and it was a money or your life proposition. interestingly, to this very day, that's exactly how the Egyptians still see it. They see it as theft. If you or any of your friends have any doubts about whether Israel was ever in Egypt, that there was even an Exodus, which, by the way, has become a very popular theme in more liberal denominations, just tell them to ask a modern-day Egyptian about it. The anger over Israel taking all that gold and silver from Egypt has remained a bitter sore spot in the national heart of the Egyptian people right up to today, 3,500 years later. Let us not overlook just what is at the bottom of this decision by God to crush Egypt with these supernatural devastations and then plundering their gold and silver. God reminds us in verse 7 that this is all done in order that you may know that Yahweh makes a distinction between Egypt and Israel. We keep hearing this over and over in the Exodus story of the plagues, don't we? It is that God makes a distinction between Israel and Egypt. When God keeps repeating something, it's a sure bet we need to pay attention. Let us not ever think that this setting apart of Israel from the rest of the world is some minor or remote issue, or it's changed, or it's become obsolete. Remember, from a biblical standpoint, Egypt, which is real and tangible, is also a type. That is, Egypt is representative of the world at large, all those who are not joined to Israel. Egypt is a representative of the world at large. To this very day and to the end of our time, God sees the world as Israel on one side, everybody else on the other. Where does that leave us? Gentile believers. Thankfully, it leaves us with Israel, as part of Israel. This is one good reason to follow God's directive to bless Israel. Because when we bless Israel, we're also in a way blessing ourselves. Romans 9, 10, and 11 covers this in great detail, but it can be summed up by Romans 11, 17, where Paul says in his olive tree analogy, "But if some of the branches were broken off, and you, Gentile believer, you, a wild olive, were grafted in among them, and you become an equal sharer in the rich root of the olive tree," see? So Israel is symbolized in Scripture as the olive tree. And in Romans 11, 24, "For if you Gentiles were cut out of what is by nature a wild olive tree and grafted contrary to nature into a cultivated olive tree, Israel, how much more will these natural branches," those Israelites who were cut off because of their disbelief, "how much more they will be grafted back into their own olive tree?" In other words, from God's spiritual perspective, a Gentile believer is grafted into the covenants of Israel. It is those covenants that, from a spiritual aspect, makes Israel, Israel. And it separates them from everybody else. God did not make his covenants with Gentiles. They were only made with Israel. By trusting in Jesus as Lord and Messiah, however, we are grafted in to the covenants of Israel. No, I'm not saying you became a Jew when you got saved. There are physical Jews and there are physical Gentiles. But by God's reckoning, neither a physical Jew nor a physical Gentile automatically belongs to true spiritual Israel, or as Paul calls it, the Israel of God. Only those Jews and Gentiles who believe and trust Yeshua as the Messiah. Again, I caution you, I'm not saying that as a physical member of the tribe of Israel that you're now no longer an Israelite. I'm saying that there is an earthly, fleshly, physical perspective on the one hand, and there is a spiritual heavenly perspective that God has, on the other hand, salvation, deliverance, this concerns only the spiritual, not the physical. God did not come to save our fleshly lives. He came to save our eternal souls. What we need to come away from with our study of Torah is this. God made and demonstrated a distinction between Israel and everybody else. Here in Exodus, it's a distinction between Israel and the Egyptians. This is such an important foundational principle. Israel was set apart to be God's special people. When we hear the commonly used church word, sanctification, it simply means set apart for God. That's all that word means. This is not some Old Testament distinction that's been dissolved. It remains intact in the New Testament. Yeshua did not in this distinction between Israel and the world. My goodness, he himself was a Jew. He was an Israelite. And he made a point of letting people know that. He simply provided a new and lasting way for Gentiles to partake of, to be grafted into Israel's covenants by means of his own blood. Now, please don't misunderstand. Even the new covenant was not a covenant between God and Gentiles. It was a covenant between God and Israel. Now, we're not going to go any further with that for right now, because that is a very long lesson all in itself. But I do want to quote this passage that says it well. This is the passage where the New Testament is first announced. This is in Jeremiah 31, verses 30 through 32. It says, "Hear, the days are coming, says Adonai, when I will make a new covenant the house of Israel and with the house of Judah. It will not be like the covenant I made with their fathers on the day I took them by their hand and brought them out of the land of Egypt, because they, for their part, violated my covenant, even though I, for my part, was a husband to them, says Adonai. For this is the covenant I will make with the house of Israel after those days, says Adonai. I'll put my Torah within them and write it on their hearts. I will be their God, they will be my people." Who did God say the new covenant is being made with and for? Israel, it's right there. Specifically, so that we can't get it confused with the house of Judah and with the house of Israel. There's no mistaking it. So let's back up for a moment. It was during these 3 days of darkness, Choshech, that had fallen upon Egypt, that Moses pronounced to Pharaoh what? The coming death of the firstborn. Yet while all Egypt was cowering under the horror of the complete absence of light and this thick blanket of evil that lay over them, Israel was celebrating joyously because they were experiencing light. They knew their time of deliverance was near. In fact, during that time of darkness for Egypt, Israel had 4 days before Jehovah would go throughout Egypt killing all the firstborn, already selected their Passover lambs. They did this according with God's instructions. This would become the establishment of Passover. Let's fast forward now, about 1,400 years to 30 AD. We're in Jerusalem. It's Passover, in Hebrew, Pesach. Yeshua has completed his special pre-Passover meal in the company of his 12 disciples the evening before. Now he's nailed, bleeding and suffocating on this execution stake. But before death overtakes him, the land suddenly becomes covered in a thick, terrifying darkness. Yeshua, our Passover lamb, was selected and sacrificed when all was dark. Literally, spiritually, for the world. But in heaven, a kind of bittersweet joyousness was taking place because deliverance was at hand. And another important milestone in the redemption of mankind was occurring. There should have been a muted celebration in Jerusalem among the Jews, but they were blinded to the truth. They could not see that Christ was their deliverance. Yeshua was their Passover lamb. Let's fast forward again now. 2,000 years from Christ's passion to today. Our world is becoming darker and darker and darker. Our entire planet is becoming so evil and rebellious. We're under choshech, spiritual darkness. It's hard not to be despondent. It's hard not to feel a sense of hopelessness and despair and confusion. So we just watch our world reeling out of control. But you know what? As believers, those of us who are set apart and sanctified for God, what should our reaction be? Should be the same as those Israelites in Egypt who we're reading about in Exodus. Celebration. All those who do not know God are in darkness, and they're about to experience spiritual death. We who do know God live in his light, and we are about to experience deliverance into eternal light. The example of how we are to live during these last days, as each new day reveals new and deeper levels of man's wickedness and depravity, it's right here in Exodus. We can and we should actually take it from God's perspective. Final, complete deliverance is at hand. Yet like the Israelites, our joy is bittersweet. Like those Israelites, we all have friends and relatives and neighbors that made the choice to join with the world, to toil under its darkness. The sad fact is that until Messiah Yeshua reigns on earth, light and darkness, death and life are going to rule together simultaneously. We're going to stop here and pick up next week.
Help support God's people by purchasing items made by them. Merchandise with a meaning, products with a purpose. HolyLandMarketplace.com. For more teachings, visit, support, or donate at TorahClass.com. Join with us in worship and enjoy God's Word at Seed of Abraham Fellowship.